Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back our research analyst, Damian Schott. Damian is a university student studying economics, and he is going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole with the rest of you. Damian, welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be back here.
All right, Damian, let's get into the continuation of this conversation around the fiat traditional system, inflation, the way that money is created, and Bitcoin and Bitcoin's role in the future and how it really changes the game of monetary economics. So I'll turn it over to you.
Well, one of the big questions that I really wanted answered was, what encourages people to spend money in a system where their savings are increasing in value? If you're saving in Bitcoin, then your savings are gaining more and more value that you can spend later. So why would you want to go spend in the economy? And then wouldn't that slow down the economy?
It's a great question. And when you hear traditional economics school of thought around consumption and the growth of economies due to credit growth and consumption growth, this is the way that economics are taught. But it doesn't mean that it's necessarily right or wrong. And I say that because if we're a student and we want to think about how the world works and how it could work differently, then instead of saying the way it works now is correct or incorrect and then we'll fix it, I don't think that's the right approach. So let's just assess what it is. If you have a money that appreciates in value, you are incentivized to hoard it and not spend it. And in that way, you would not be creating consumption and therefore wouldn't have a consumption-based economy necessarily. That's a valid point. But let's introduce this concept here. So in your economics class, you know that GDP is the sum of what? What are the parts of GDP, the traditional just nominal GDP calculation that we go with?
It was money supply and investment.
Right. And so you have consumption and investment is actually what it is. So consumption and investment are the two components of GDP, right? Now, you know also that in your economics calculations, your GDP calculations, that S equals I, right? Savings equals investment. So you only can do two things with the money that you earn. You can save it or you can consume. If you save it, by definition, you are investing, right? And so if that's one topic here. So if you're earning in dollars, let's say, you can spend those dollars or you can hoard the dollars, but the hoarding of the dollars is basically buying bonds. So you're lending money to a company or a country, let's say. In the way that you're lending money, you aren't consuming yourself, but you're giving firepower to another participant in the economy to spend, right? In Bitcoin, if you hoard and you don't spend, the hoarding, it's like gold where it goes into a vault and it's not actually spent into the economy. So your point is valid in that it would necessarily slow down consumption if people earned in Bitcoin and are attracted by higher value of their savings tomorrow, therefore incentivizing savings and de-incentivizing consumption. But the question is that world a better or worse world with less consumption and more savings and therefore more investment? Because if you save, that means that you can consume or invest in the future. And so I don't want us as people that are learning about Bitcoin and are spreading education about Bitcoin, I don't want us to claim that less consumption in the future, if we go to a more Bitcoin-centric, is good for economic growth. That might not be an economically, mathematically sound proposition, but it doesn't mean that it's bad for society. And I would challenge you to internalize what deferred gratification is and deferred consumption and savings and investment over consumption and those economic schools of thought, to see what the benefits are of those instead of latching on to that consumption might be worse, so GDP might be lower, which I'm not arguing, Damien. It's an important point, but these are the things that we have to challenge ourselves to think through and to dream up in a Bitcoin future, because we already know what it's like with gold. So one of your questions was about what happens in a bank run with hard money. Well, we actually know what happens in a bank run with hard money. We got the experience from 1929 to 1933. It was on two continents. So it was happening in New York. It was happening in Europe as well. We had financial crises in the United Kingdom and on the continent. We had a financial crisis in Italy that spread to Austria in 1931. All of these depositors, what do you think they were going for? They were going for hard currency, which gave them access to gold. So maybe the bank didn't have gold, but the bank had hard currency, which means government currency. The government currency promised to pay gold. And so in a bank run, what happened from 1929 to 1933, you can Google it. We had several thousand bank closures. We had contraction of GDP. And because we had a gold reserve ratio, a gold coverage ratio mandated by the US government through the Fed, we couldn't expand the money supply enough to account for the bank runs and the contraction in the money supply. What that means is that the traditional economists are correct in that a hard currency tied banking system is destined to have bank runs, and that the only way to stop that is a central banking system that has a lender of last resort. And the lender of last resort is a concept from 19th century Bank of England monetary economics, Walter Badgett, who's a name that comes up time and time again on the Bitcoin layer, because we love our history and we love to understand the origins of these things. So what is the origin of the lender of last resort, of the central bank to prevent bank runs collapsing a bank? Because if a bank is experiencing a bank run, who do they turn to? If they run out of gold in the vault, who do they turn to? It's over. But if they can shut the vault and turn to the central bank for paper assistance, meaning they have some way to say to their customers, hey, I'm not going to give you your gold, but I'll give you this piece of paper, and maybe me as a bank, I'll go away, but you will be made whole because you'll have a piece of paper with the government's name on it instead of a deposit with me. That's the central bank. That's the lender of last resort. So either it keeps the bank alive or the bank goes away and the customer either is the customer of another bank now or will be a new customer with some government form of paper they can take to a new bank. So hard currency-backed banking systems have failed. We have the evidence, 1929 to 1933. Should we try it again with Bitcoin? Or should we do more free market banking, which is what we talked about last time, where every bank's instrument is its own free-floating monetary occurrence? And maybe that's too hectic, and maybe there is a middle ground, and I believe there is a middle ground there between totally free banking and every bank having their own stablecoin, theoretically, with a different interest rate on it, versus every deposit is backed by the Fed and the Treasury Department and the FDIC. There is a middle ground, and I believe Bitcoin will push us to that middle ground. And it's not a hard currency-backed financial system explicitly. because that requires what? Printing of money. And how do you print Bitcoin? You physically can't. So it doesn't work with Bitcoin. You can't print gold either. And that's why gold failed. The Fed couldn't just find more gold to put on their balance sheet in the crisis. It had to basically obliterate its 35% gold coverage ratio, which it did. Bitcoin is hitting its stride with massive ETF inflows, large geopolitical changes, and the prospect of a United States strategic Bitcoin reserve. 2025 is shaping up to be a defining year for Bitcoin. And here's the real question that you guys need to be asking yourself. Are you prepared? And is your Bitcoin house in order? If you're not sure, you're in luck, because on December 10th, Unchained is hosting a free web event that is an essential session to prepare yourselves for what is ahead. You'll walk away with a clear plan for your end of year moves, smart strategies for bringing your family into Bitcoin, and the confidence of knowing that you are set up for the long haul. Join Unchained's General Counsel Jeff Vandrew and Adamant Capital founder Tor Demeester for an unbelievable session to get you guys positioned for the year end, all your tax strategies, retirement strategies, any question that you might have about Bitcoin planning. With a bull run gaining momentum, this is your window to prepare for what's ahead. Register at unchained.com/TBL for this free web event. Do not write your Bitcoin seed phrases on paper. A lot of Bitcoin, guys, is lost forever, and poor seed phrase management is a big reason why. That is why we use Stampseed. Go check them out at stampseed.com for 21% off of your entire order with the code TBL. Stampseed sells DIY titanium seed phrase kits. They send you these titanium plates. They send you a very heavy duty hammer. And what you do is you hammer your seed phrase into these titanium plates. These plates are fireproof up to 3000 degrees. They're rust proof, crush proof, and time proof. So it allows you to really keep these seed phrases in a way that lasts the test of time. You can use them in your single sig or your multi-sig setups. So go check them out today. Stampseed.com, use code TBL for 21% off of your entire order. This is a Black Friday sale that is going from November 23rd to December 3rd. Go to stampseed.com and use code TBL.
So in a Bitcoin-backed system, there is actually a place for a central bank as a last resort lender in the same way. That's awesome.
Well, if you have a Bitcoin-backed system, so first of all, if you had a Bitcoin-backed system, it would have to be backed by Bitcoin per a government, right? Mm-hmm. So the government says, hey, our currency is backed by Bitcoin. Okay, mm-hmm. I don't believe that that's part of our future, right? Mm-hmm. But if the government were to say, hey, we're backing our currency by Bitcoin, the government would have to have a stockpile of Bitcoin mm-hmm. to make whole people or institutions that have relied on the government for a lender of last resort or some institutional backing for their and so the government, in the government's own exploration mm-hmm. of whether to back its currency with Bitcoin, the government has to think, well, if I learn from history, gold-backed currencies that become popular might not be able to last because enough credits will be issued and draw on my gold, the limited amount of gold I have. So it will deplete my gold stock, which is what happened to the United States in the 1960s. France and Spain said, I want my gold back. This isn't the 30s anymore. This is the 60s. I want my gold back. And the US had to give it. But then they had to close the gold window because they could. How are they? They were going to get depleted, Damien, because there were more dollar. There were more dollars than gold in the vault. So, you know, get. I mean, literally, right? So you have to close it. And, you know, that's just what that's the nature of a hard currency system. So we shouldn't be advocating for the US to back the dollar with Bitcoin. What we should be advocating is for United States citizens and companies and municipalities, states, and even the federal government to own Bitcoin and be stakeholders in this network to boost our relative competitiveness in the world. If Bitcoin is going to be a used technology, we want to be the home of Bitcoin in the US. We don't need to make our dollar backed by Bitcoin. That doesn't seem like that is the approach for anybody. But to your credit, Damien, the world, as it learns about Bitcoin and they think that it's a currency, they might think, hey, is this currency going to replace that currency? Mm-hmm. Bitcoin as a currency is a very basic way to understand it. It's much more than a currency. It can be used with as a currency. It has currency-like flow properties where it can be transacted, but it's more an asset, more a commodity, more a property, piece of property than it is a currency with how the protocol works, right? It comes into existence and there's a supply of it. That's not how currencies work. Currencies are issued by banks, right? Or by governments. It's a balance sheet operation. Bitcoin is not a balance sheet operation. It's a virtual commodity. And the CFTC, the commodities regulator in the United States, identified Bitcoin as a virtual commodity in 2015 and IRS property, right? In 2013 or 14, the IRS said Bitcoin is property and the CFTC said Bitcoin is a virtual commodity. Nobody said Bitcoin's a currency. We actually need the U.S. government to give it currency designation going forward to allow better tax treatment of Bitcoin, basically non-punitive tax treatment of Bitcoin, so that it can flow like a currency without people having to pay capital gains tax on a Bitcoin transaction, which is ridiculous. But by the law, that's the way that it is today in the U.S. So those laws will change over time, but hopefully that covers the hoarding issue, the hard money issue, and how Bitcoin fits into the future. It's not that Bitcoin is the currency now. Mm-hmm. It's that Bitcoin is the alternative asset. The alternative asset used to be real estate. Then it was shares in venture capital. Then it's some form of collectibles, right? Because traditional assets are what? Stocks and bonds. Even gold was or still is considered an alternative asset. Bitcoin is now the alternative asset, right? We're still going to have stocks. We're still going to have bonds. We're still going to have deposits. We're still going to have banks. We're still going to have currencies. We're still going to have central banks. We're still going to have treasury deficits, borrow and spend. I don't envision any of that going away in the next 10 years. And who am I to project beyond that, really? But the way I see Bitcoin is becoming just more and more the only alternative, or basically joining stocks and bonds as the third traditional asset class.
So now that I'm understanding that Bitcoin is meant to really coexist alongside these systems as an alternative asset, and it's interesting that it's always compared to gold, I'm wondering exactly what gives Bitcoin its intrinsic value, because to me, gold is very straightforward. Gold has had value its entire lifespan because humans simply value it as jewelry. They think it's aesthetically pleasing. They want it as jewelry, so they want to hold on to gold. It's a shiny, pretty metal. But Bitcoin doesn't have any of these attributes. It's only scarce. But so what really gives it value?
Yes, it's an excellent question. So I would recommend Damien and the audience go take a second listen to our part two with Michael Howell, where we talk about hashing and mining. Now, Damien brings up a good point that gold has beauty, it's aesthetically pleasing, and it has thousands of years and multiple continents, generations, and cultures to agree on this concept. So it's in human nature to be attracted to gold, right? It's one of the periodic elements. I'm sorry, it's one of the elements on the periodic table, and it there's something natural about gold, right? So the reason that Bitcoin also has beauty. So the reason that Bitcoin also has beauty, and that's where Damien, I would say that you're missing something here. There is an elegance and a beauty to Bitcoin. And that beauty can only be seen when looking under the hood at how Bitcoin works and how Bitcoin comes into existence, right? How gold comes to existence is from the earth. So it appears from the earth, or it's in the earth's crust. You have to dig. And when you dig, you find this thing that's beautiful in the ground, and you had to work to get that. So the difficulty target and the range of hash outputs that we can get when we hash Bitcoin. So a miner, when a miner is trying to mine Bitcoin, what a miner is doing is it's performing hashes. A hash is a mathematical function. And when you perform the hash, you get, just like in any equation, you have an input and an output. So the output from that hash, that equation, can be a number from 0 to 2 to the 256th power. A number so large that our brains really can't comprehend it, right? The number of grains of sand on the planet is often one way that like a human can start to conceptualize the number, but really it's too large for us to conceptualize. The number is so large that the way Bitcoin has elegance is new Bitcoin only comes into existence if the output from the hash is such a small number that you literally have zeros as far as the eye can see at the beginning of the output. I mean, it's such a small number that you have to get. And when you try, and I'm not a miner myself, some of our audience thinks I'm, I don't know why they think I'm mining here. I'm not, guys, I don't know. But I'm not a miner, okay? I'm a researcher that just, I like to read and look at the candlesticks. When you mine, you are performing this equation. And when you actually find a valid block and propagate that block to the Bitcoin network, and the network recognizes that you have awarded yourself 100, I'm sorry, that you've rewarded yourself 3 1/8 Bitcoin today, and you can spend it after 100 blocks, you've just created $200,000 worth of virtual commodity from performing hashes on your computer or your computing device. And you at this given time might not find the beauty or not might not recognize the beauty in that. But a Bitcoin price at $94,000 and, you know, 1¾ trillion of market cap, there is a beauty that has been recognized by the market embedded in that price and value. Your question is, where is the intrinsic value? It's in the hashes. We are in what block? We are in block 800,000. I'm going to get it for us because it's important. Okay, we are in block 870,000 plus or minus. Okay. 870,000 blocks have gone by. 870,000 rewards have been given out to miners. And each one of these blocks that comes, the block reward is either hoarded or sold, right? There's only two things you can do with that income. You can hoard it or sell it. When the miners sell it, the people that are paying the price, they give their market value, what they believe it's worth. That's a market price, right? Price governs what we do at the Bitcoin layer, Damien. So the intrinsic value, if you tell me that this Picasso painting is worth 100 mil and this Leonardo da Vinci painting is worth $900 million, right? And you'd say, okay, this was worth 100 million, this is worth 900 million. I'll say, okay, when did they last trade? And you say, well, the Leonardo da Vinci one has never traded. It's been owned by this or that European royal, and it's in a museum, and it's still owned by this crown or this museum, and it's never traded. I would say, I don't know if it's worth 900 million, but an assessor might think it's worth that, but the Picasso traded at 50 million 8 years ago, and then it just sold last year for 83 million at a Sotheby's auction. And we had a similar painting go for 120. So I think this one's worth at least 100. And I would say that's, you probably have the price somewhat accurate there. Does it mean that the Picasso is more valuable or more intrinsically valuable than the Leonardo da Vinci painting? Or we just have a better reference of price because it traded more often? Bitcoin trades every second in every continent, in every currency, 24 hours a day, no weekend breaks, nothing. So the intrinsic value is the hash. I'm telling you, it's the hashes, and it's awarded by the market at all times. So it might just feel that it's scarce. If there's one thing that you and the students want to do, if you want to answer this question that Damien asked, what is the intrinsic value of Bitcoin? The answer is hashes and how mining works. And the way to do it is the way that I did it, okay? Mastering Bitcoin, second edition, by Andreas Antonopoulos. And in this book, which is now quite old, and some of the technical stuff is actually a little not obsolete, it's a little out of date, right? Bitcoin has matured in its software structure. But if you want to take the leap, become a computer scientist tourist and read Mastering Bitcoin. It's the only way besides, and there are lots of people that have explained how Bitcoin works and how mining works. Take the dive into how mining works, understand the words target, difficulty, inputs and outputs, SHA-256, and only through that will you fully appreciate the intrinsic value of Bitcoin. Thank you guys for joining us today at the Bitcoin Layer. This has been an excellent conversation. I know Damien has a lot more questions, so we're going to keep teaching Bitcoin through the lens of a traditional economic student and answer the tough questions. And we'll catch you guys next time.